Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour of the program, we're going to be talking about intelligent design with Dr. Thomas Woodward. You know, that's what we ought to do for open lines sometime, Jeff. Christmas lights. Before the quote-unquote holiday season has come to its conclusion, I don't know. I checked the church calendar, and the Christmas season doesn't start until December 24th, and then it goes on for several weeks after that. We seem to have turned things around. We ought to talk about Christmas lights. The arch opponent of all Christmas lights on the outside of any structures, because I don't want to be, I guess I'm just a nonconformist. Keep the lights inside. I don't want to light the neighborhood. That's what it is. I'm paying for the electricity. If my neighbors want to read the newspaper on my front porch, they can go to their front porch under their Christmas lights. I don't want to light the neighborhood. I don't want to heat the neighborhood. I don't want to light the neighborhood. That's why I'm always walking around the house, turning the lights off. And if we had Christmas lights, I would drive my wife crazy because I would constantly be unplugging them so that it didn't light the neighborhood. Okay, we'll talk about it during open lines sometime in the coming weeks. Intelligent design has, I guess you could say, it's made quite a splash in the scientific community. The splash has started about 20 years ago, and the wave seems to be riding higher and higher. But why has the community still adhering to evolution, why have they been sounding the alarm bells so persistently since intelligent design reared its ugly head, as they would think? We're going to talk about intelligent design and the ongoing battle with Darwinian evolution for the next half hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Thomas Woodward has written the book called Darwin Strikes Back, Defending the Science of Intelligent Design. He's professor at Trinity College in Florida, where he teaches the history of science, communication, and systematic theology. Dr. Woodward, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Why all the alarms in the circles of evolution over ID?
Well, I could cite a couple reasons. One is that this is a movement that really arose among not the lay public or Christian public even, but among professors. I mean, many of them are biochemists. There's one or two that are outside of the science area. Philip Johnson, a law professor at Berkeley, but he had tremendous status as an intellectual on the Berkeley campus, a senior figure. But you think of Michael Behe. I mean, he is not in any way, shape, or form your typical conservative, let's say, fundamentalist Christian. He is a Christian by his own denominational identification. But these guys were all led into their, if you will, doubt about Darwin by encounters with the evidence. And they make it clear that, hey, they used to accept evolution, and then they encountered powerful empirical evidence that turned them around, that turned them in a new direction. And that just drives the Darwinian camp crazy. It's also, secondly, spreading overseas. Huge conferences being held now in Europe. A big splash in Britain just in the last 2 weeks. It's the headline news in Britain. Scientists over there are sending DVDs on the case for ID, for intelligent design, to public high schools. And I think that this is sending a lot of alarm bells off all over the United States, and I'm beginning to do it all over the world. And maybe we can go into some more of those reasons.
Should the advocates of macroevolution be worried about the status of their theory?
Well, quite frankly, if I was an advocate of macroevolution, I would really take a deep breath and say, okay, what is the strongest case for the idea, not just that life forms are related, but the idea that nature, all on its own, has written reams of computer code in the DNA. See, that's where I think that the macroevolution theory is falling apart. It's literally in a state of collapse as I speak, because with the discovery of DNA along with, you know, the RNA and protein codes, these are literally like computer codes. They've been compared to Microsoft codes, and they're not just a little bit. I mean, there's massive gigabytes of code in every cell, even down at the level of bacteria, and the complexity of the code is astounding. And so the inability of blind chance, if you will, blind natural selection working on, you know, code glitches, if you will, mutations or like typo errors, the inability of that process to produce what we see is staggering. And I think macroevolution is going to suffer a collapse within the next 10 years. It'll be far, far greater than anything we've seen, even the Berlin Wall going down. I mean, the big one is coming.
You write about what are really relatively modest claims put forth by the advocates of intelligent design. You summarize it by saying, certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection. That is a very modest claim.
It is.
So why has that claim had so much impact in the last 20 years?
Well, even though it is a modest claim, it's basically, it's like the dike, you know, the little kid who kept his finger in the dike and then another hole opened up in the water, and you can't keep plugging the dike. If you have one place where nature cannot explain its own complexity, it points to a higher intelligence, or at least to an intelligent agent. And that is, that drives the traditional, let's say the science since Darwin's day, let's say the science since 1859, has been dominated by a worldview. It's been dominated by a preferred or even enforced ideology, and that's called naturalism. And naturalism is in steep decline. The idea that nature is all there is, ain't nothing else, to use the jargon of, let's say, if I were to speak country. You know, if nature is all there is, yeah, then naturalism fits with Darwinism and the two mutually reinforce each other. But if we find things in nature that nature can't account for, then that points beyond nature to something else, some embedded intelligence or creative intelligence.
Now that brings us to something that you mentioned in the middle of your book, and that is basically Darwin's own admission that there is a way in which his theory of evolution could in fact be falsified.
Absolutely.
Talk about that if you would.
Sure. Well, it's a really a quote that many of the writers of the intelligent design movement have used. It basically says, and I will not use my British accent. Well, maybe I will. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Darwin said that in a chapter on difficulties with his theory, and he basically admitted that if you found a system which cannot, as it were, be incrementally, step by tiny Darwinian step built, his theory collapses. And he, in his book, he said, well, I don't see any such example right now. And he even says, well, eyes, you can imagine eyes going from this level to this level, different kinds of eyes. But Michael Behe has brought out in his work of the famous book, Darwin's Black Box, which has been a bestseller now for 10 years. It's in its 10th anniversary edition. Michael Behe shows that there are nano machines, tiny, micro, miniaturized, literally exquisite machinery inside the cell, sometimes having as many as 200 to 300 parts, each of these like just wonderfully crafted cogs and gears and levers and pulleys and clamps, things that remind us of very sophisticated equipment that we have in maybe our machine shop or our computer room. And so when Darwin's theory cannot account for the step-by-tiny-step development, which when you only get the function with all the parts are there, this is called irreducible complexity. And the irreducible complexity of these machines is like a huge piece of evidence lying on the table that the Darwinists are struggling mightily to account for. It's actually, they're discussing it in the main journals now. It's not just swept over to one side.
Can Darwinian evolution, you talk about the nanomachines within a living cell, can Darwinian evolution even explain something as simple as the origin of something far less complex molecularly, that is proteins, the basic building blocks of life?
Actually, I do not believe that they can even come close to accounting for a single protein. Now, people may say, well, what's the big deal about a protein? We recently had a conference here in Florida where we commissioned a sculptor to produce a 28-foot-long protein model, which had little Nerf balls that are kind of like squiggly shaped, you know, all weird shapes, and he linked them together. Beautiful model. That Nerf ball protein model is just fantastic because it shows that every single one of those colored Nerf balls has to be arranged just right, like a long, long word, anti-disestablishmentarianism or supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, but maybe 10 times longer. And if you move one of the letters around, that protein piece of, it's like a piece of spaghetti, which snaps suddenly in the water, it snaps into a 3D shape. Well, the proteins are dependent upon the specific sequences of their building blocks, their letters, if you will. And if the letters are not right, the protein won't shape, it won't form, it won't snap to attention. And so what I argue in the book is that everybody's overlooking even the most fundamental level of complexity, which is each individual protein is like a micro-miniaturized universe of breathtaking complexity. And the chance of forming one protein out of a universe full of soup jostling and trying to hold hands is just, you know, infinitesimal. It won't happen in a trillion years.
Folks, we're giving away the book Darwin Strikes Back to listeners with best questions or comments in the next 15 minutes of our conversation with Dr. Thomas Woodward, the book's author. Our call-in number, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're tuned to Issues Etc., and we're coming back with you live here on this Tuesday, November the 28th. How would you summarize or characterize the conventional wisdom regarding the critique of ID in the evolutionary community? How would you summarize the basic critique that they level at intelligent design?
Well, it comes from many directions. The most important, if you will, slogan or even mantra is ID is religion, not science. In other words, they'll say something that a variation of that. They'll say, you know, this implies a supernatural designer. Well, ID does not imply a supernatural designer because you cannot figure from looking at a machine whether it was made by an extraterrestrial, a human, you know, some other higher power. And when the DNA, you look at a DNA, it doesn't have made by Yahweh or made by Jesus Christ in the lower right-hand corner. But let me get back to their critique. They say, secondly, that intelligent design is not testable. It, you know, you can't test it. And then they'll turn around 10 minutes later and say, by the way, we've tested it and found it wanting. So they kind of, you know, they want it both ways. I argue that ID is eminently testable and has passed the many, many tests with flying colors. I don't know of a single test that it's failed. And then thirdly, they would say, well, ID is just religiously motivated. That's really strange because anybody who knows the score, and I've written two books on it now, knows that every single leader of the ID movement was led into their doubt of Darwin or their embracing of design by the evidence and the evidence alone. Some of them are Christians. I'd say most of them are theists or even Christians, but you know, you really can't make many ways by saying, well, Michael Behe has been seen entering and leaving churches, you know. And as if that makes him automatically a non-thinking person.
What about the, and I guess it kind of is tied up with the things that you have just mentioned, what about the basic critique leveled at ID that it rejects science, that it is in itself a rejection of the scientific method and of an entire scientific worldview?
Well, I mean, it depends on how science is defined. If someone says, well, science must be the search for nature-only causes, like, you know, nature must explain everything, then really that's a theological definition of science. And I guess if someone wants to define science theologically, almost like atheist theology, then, well, sure, yeah, we do not conform to that view of science. We think that view of science is outmoded, it's biased, it doesn't work at all to be actually sensitive to the leading of the evidence. So the argument that ID is not science is itself a very, I think, weak argument because it begs the question of what is science. We believe science is the search for the best answers, you know, or the accurate answers about origins, not the naturalistic answers. The moment you say, well, it has to be the naturalistic answer, well, then you don't even need to look at the evidence. You know in advance that things evolved because of your chosen definition of what science is.
So in other words, that view of science would say, science is the pursuit of evidence that supports our particular view of where everything came from.
Yeah, evidence and explanations, little explanatory, you know, stories that support. But yes, you're right on. You're precisely correct.
Let's talk with Judy in McCook, Nebraska. She listens on KNGN, our sister station up there. Judy, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, hello, Todd.
Hello.
I'm glad to get on again. I have a question that's always bothered me about evolution, and maybe your guest can answer this. In the process of, you know, evolution, how does maleness and femaleness develop at exactly the same time spans in order to have procreation? I guess that's my question.
All right, Judy, thank you very much, and thanks for listening up there in McCook. How do they explain sexual reproduction, I guess?
It's a huge problem. It really is a staggering problem for macroevolutionary theory. And they have various scenarios, and the bottom line is that sexual development, the sexual way of procreation developed because it allowed for greater shuffling around, if you will, of the gene components, of the little genes that are attached to this string of information that we call the genome. And because of the shuffling process that is required when you combine, you know, you bring half of the DNA from the male, half the DNA from the female, you shuffle it all around like a pack of cards, and then, wow, look at the combinations you get. And then because of that, you know, things were able to progress and evolve more. Well, that's a huge assumption in itself. The transition is not is very poorly understood, in other words, very poorly theorized at this point, in my view. I'm not an expert in this area, but I've read enough to know that it remains a staggering problem.
Bob writes this from Newport via email in Vermont. He says, how can intelligent design avoid the, quote, God of the gaps trap into which Christians of earlier centuries sometimes fell? That's his first question for you. How would you respond?
I would respond two ways. First of all, intelligent design has religious implications, but intelligent design does not depend on religious premises. In other words, we don't go in our reasoning process. I mean, I go in personally as a believing Christian, but we don't, as scientists, go in and say, well, we know God is the explanation for direct intervention to produce structure X. Now, we look at the evidence on its own terms, and then we infer a designing agent. The agent, the nature, and the IQ power of that agent is unknown until you may find some kind of signature or fingerprint. But we don't find that in these machines. So, you know, God of the gaps accusation doesn't fit at all because God is not being brought into it. God may be an implication. Secondly, it's the growth of evidence. It's not gaps of evidence. It's what we're learning about nanomachines. It's what we're learning after 50 years of origin of life research that has led us to the conclusion, hey, this is a huge cul-de-sac. The more we learn, the more we realize it can't happen by nature alone.
Bob also asks, can you give a rough estimate of the percentage of intelligent design scholars who are either six-day creationists or theistic evolutionists? You've perused a lot of the material, a lot of the writing.
Right.
How would you break it down?
Oh, that's a good question. That's one of the more interesting and challenging questions I've ever received. Most ID scientists, theorists, tend to be progressive creationists. In other words, they believe that they're not theistic evolutionists. They don't believe that Darwinian evolution did much of anything other than minor variations. So they reject Darwinian evolution as an explanation. Almost everyone does. I know of one exception. And so there's, I'd say, maybe 1 or 2% theistic evolutionists. And then six-day creationists, I myself hold to what I call young Earth, old universe. So I hold to six literal days, but I don't think day one was the first day of the universe. I think God created the universe in an earlier primordial epoch and then created the earth in 6 days. So I would be in that tiny group, maybe 3 to 5% of the ID advocates, so maybe slightly more, would be at least have a young earth view.
I guess the question I have after Bob's is, if you're looking at ID scholars, does it matter what position they hold on the issue of creation? In the debate.
Well, in our discussions, we may, you know, over a cup of coffee say, by the way, what's your view? How do you think, you know, this whole thing came together? And so it's like a sidebar, you know, it's kind of like a side discussion that's interesting, but it's not really central to what we're doing. We're trying to show from the evidence that intelligence can be detected. You can now, by looking at physical evidence and analyzing it in terms of the statistical probabilities, you can tell whether an intelligence was involved in monkeying with any physical system. And that's an exciting breakthrough of science, and it has implications, of course, for theology. And it's a major advance on science. And I could go into that, you know, a little bit more later in the work of Bill Dembski.
Let's talk with Andy in Kirkwood. Andy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Frequently in the media, you see offered examples of evolution, and these are always played up very big in the media, and then later on when they're shown to be false, you don't hear anything about it. The latest thing that I've seen was in a magazine I looked at last week, and it was a dolphin or a porpoise with feet. And what these turned out to be in the photograph was little vestigial kinds of things sticking out near the tail of the creature.
Mm-hmm.
So you might just address the idea of these frequently offered examples. Also, my understanding is that chemistry absolutely contradicts evolution. You were talking about the building of the protein. There's something called, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, chirality.
You got it.
Which would make evolution impossible. And then also yesterday I saw an article on rapid genetic change produced by the environment, which is continued on then for two or three generations. They were talking about mice that turned out to be darker in color as the generations went by, but I don't know if you've heard of that or not.
All right, let's deal with those three, Andy. Thank you very much for laying them on the table. Can you give us a few minutes on the other side of this break, Dr. Woodward?
Yes, I can.
All right, let's deal with, first of all, his concern about the media examples that are often put forward as kind of the ironclad evidence that evolution is true.
Yes, well, let me deal with that quickly. I'm not familiar with the dolphin with supposed rudimentary feet or some sort. That may be, you know, a very interesting example of genetic, you know, as it were, capacities that are there and are repressed. And, you know, the whole notion of the ability of an animal to show structures that don't normally manifest is a known ability in many, many animals. And it's begun to be organized or understood better. But in a nutshell, these examples are usually microevolutionary examples. The National Geographic loves to use microevolutionary changes and just say, okay, that's proof of macro. But tiny changes do not prove big changes.
He also raised the issue of, he used the term chirality with regard to chemistries incompatible with Darwinian evolution.
Yeah, if we have
can
time
you
on that, yeah, let me just jump in there.
You got about 2.5 minutes.
Okay, good, good. This is one of the puzzles, is that, okay, think of a protein as a bunch of colored gloves floating in of a swimming pool. And let's say that you've got all these different gloves, and there's right-handed gloves and left-handed gloves. And by chance, these gloves start to kind of somehow stick together. Maybe they've got little embedded magnets, and so they just are attracted to each other, and they start kind of hooking together and forming this strange little chain. These gloves are now chained together. That's a picture of formation, or at least the scenario of how you could form an early protein. The only problem is that the gloves, if you have equal 50% right and 50% left, are going to kind of willy-nilly start hooking up right and left. The weird thing is that the letters, the chemical letters that are used in human and all proteins, all plants, all animals, from yeast and bacteria all the way up through man and palm trees, every protein has only left-handed amino acids. But if you zap them in a pool of just chemicals, you get 50% right-handed, 50% left-handed. They're basically the same chemical formula, but they're formed mirror images of each other.
And why, with only 10 seconds, does that render the notion of evolution at the chemical level impossible?
Because you have no way in a just random sorting process of just a pool of chemicals hooking up willy-nilly, no way to sort out the right ones and just say, shoo, go away, don't hook in, that'll ruin our protein, and selecting only the left-handed to get a true working protein. That is a stumbling block and a vast mystery that is getting deeper all the time.
Let's talk with Joe here as we go in. Joe, we've only got about 30 seconds before we go to a break for your question. Then we'll get back to some of Andy's questions. Joe?
Hi. I'm not sure I understand the term microevolution in the sense that, in this context, evolution connotes no design or no intelligence, no design. But if you talk about, you know, latent characteristics that can come into existence, the genetic ability exists for that characteristic to be brought out, and therefore I don't think evolution should be, that word should be applied to it. If you use the example of breeding dogs, for example, to bring out certain characteristics.
About 5 seconds here, Joe. Oh, we'll get to Joe's question on the other side of this break. He's asking about whether we should be using the term microevolution. We'll be right back with Dr. Thomas Woodward.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. David Scare, chairman of the Department of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, with two good reasons why a man should consider studying for the pastoral ministry.
The first one is, I really think the things of this world are not really worth striving after because it's all going to be taken away. The second thing, which is really the most important thing, is that the preaching of the gospel is its own reward. And there is no other greater satisfaction to know that God has used you in a very significant way. And not that you're all that, not that we are all that important, because a few months, a few years after we pass away, we're forgotten. But just to know that you have acted in this way, and many people in the world to come are going to thank those people through whom the gospel was preached.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Find their logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to hear a school voucher case from Maine leaves a confusing patchwork of laws in place around the country. Eight families from the state wanted to use the vouchers to send their kids to a religious school, an impermissible mixing of church and state, according to the court. Steve Jordahl has the story.
Seven of the families wanted to send their kids to Catholic schools, one to an Adventist school. But their attorney, Dick Comer of the Institute for Justice, says time has run out.
This is the end of the road. This was their final shot. As long as parents are making free and independent choices, then they should be entitled to select whatever school they prefer.
Legal experts say you can't read too much into a denial from the Supreme Court. After all, they can only hear so many of the thousands of cases a year that come before them. But this denial leaves the country split on vouchers and religious schools. Bruce Hauskonecht, a focus on the family action.
In practice, what that looks like is every state statute is different, so every result comes out a little bit different.
Currently, five states have voucher programs. Wisconsin, Arizona, and Ohio allow use for religious schools, although the provision in Arizona is being challenged. Maine and Vermont don't. Sean Parnell of the Heartland Institute says if there's an upside to the confusion, it's that states allowing religious schools to participate will have the opportunity to prove it can work.
But at this early stage in the school voucher movement, I think that we're going to see the states act as laboratories of democracy, I think was the famous term.
The parents in this case sent their children to religious schools anyway, working three or sometimes four jobs to finance the education. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
All the children involved in the suit have graduated from high school, although several have younger siblings that could have benefited from a Supreme Court hearing on the case. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850, KFUO, and Thrivent Financial for Lutherans has a Christmas gift for you and your family this Advent season. Comfort and joy. Three live concerts featuring artists you hear on AM 850 KFUO. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. Join me, Chris Bergman, Laurie Gower, and an ensemble of talented singers and musicians at King of Kings Lutheran Church, Chesterfield, Wednesday, December 6th at 7 p.m. No ticket required. Visit KFUO.org. Click Comfort and Joy for more information.
You can read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, titled The Great Jesus Debates, on our website, IssuesETC.org. It's a book about the battle in the early church over the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Great Jesus Debates is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Great Jesus Debates costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. That title again, The Great Jesus Debates.
Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind.
All we are is dust in the wind.
Everything is dust in the wind.
Everything is dust in the wind.
Talk about the debate between intelligent design and Darwinian evolution. Dr. Thomas Woodward is our guest for the next few minutes. We've got callers on the line and email still to answer here. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before the break, Dr. Woodward, Joe had a question about using the term microevolution, and it ties nicely with Andy's last question when he called about rapid genetic change. Should we be using the term microevolution?
Well, I think he was referring to should we use it in cases where something already is there and it kind of gets expressed.
Simply expressions of latent characteristics.
Latent characteristics are hiding in the genes somewhere. Well, I think that any change that's observed in a species, and I will even say even in producing sister species, we've seen cases where corn plants or other kinds of plants have actually produced a doubling of the genetic material or tripling. In other words, this is called a phenomenon name. It's called polyploidy. And because of polyploidy, we know that on rare occasions, new species can be produced. But corn is still corn, even though it has two hard drives instead of one, but it's just a duplication of what's there. So sister species or varieties, new varieties, you know, tweaking, what I call like tweak the beaks. If you tweak the beak of a bird, it's still a beak. And so I think that microevolution is a very handy and very helpful explanation of what we think Darwin did right. I think Darwin did a service of pointing out the ability of species to meander, to change, basically to lose information, to degrade. What he did not ever demonstrate, and Darwinian evolution has never demonstrated since then, is that species have the ability to add vast quantities of new information and progress up the tree of life.
Let's talk to Charles, who calls from his car. Hi, Charles. Thanks for waiting.
You bet. Delighted, gentlemen. I was delighted and intrigued by the statement you made, Doctor. I'm not certain, Doctor, but anyhow, the statement you made about the collapse of the eventual collapse of evolution.
Yes.
But to be truthful, I really can't conceive the reality in view of their naturalistic worldview. If evolution will be out of the picture and then God is out of the picture, where do they go?
Well, that's a great question, and I deal with that in Chapter 12 of my new book, Darwin Strikes Back. And when I'm saying the collapse of evolution, if I said that, I spoke in error. What I'm saying is the collapse of the neo-Darwinian paradigm. The neo-Darwinian paradigm says that not only is this vast tree of life, we're all kind of interconnected and related in this one big tree of life, but also that those branches spread out, they kind of ramified or spread out through the purely random selection, or the selection of random mutations in the genetic code. Now that theory, that naturalistic theory, will wield its dominance to two new theories, I think, within the next 10 to 20 years. One will be intelligent design. I think intelligent design will move into the biology labs and be a respected competitor, along with a new naturalistic theory. Now, you may say, well, a new naturalistic theory, what's that? Well, they're already working on one. There's about five different paradigm-building programs that are going on. One is up at MIT. They're working on something called Origination of Organismal Form, or OOF, and you can read about it in my book, and there's some other ideas. Stuart Kaufman in the Santa Fe Institute is talking about self-organization, and they don't have any intelligence embedded in their paradigm, but they are not Darwinian. They reject the neo-Darwinian paradigm. They say it only works at the micro level. Well, hello, that's exactly what we've been saying for the last 20, 30 years. So I think it's a very exciting time, and I think neo-Darwinian empire or paradigm will collapse into smithereens within the next 10 years.
So finally, then, no pun intended, how much life does the neo-Darwinian paradigm still have in it? How much longer do you think the debate can sustain itself?
Well, I think that, you know, what's really speeding this up at an incredible race, at a pace, is that the readouts of genomes, you see, we're reading now, I don't know, something like 10 new genetic, you know, libraries are read each month. It used to take us like 3 years to do one of them. We're getting 10 a month now. And this new information we're finding shows so much unique DNA in each individual kind of animal that is unconnected and there's nothing analogous in any other species or type of species anywhere else in the animal kingdom. These are called orphan genes, and this phenomenon of orphan genes is now accelerating. And the geneticists are literally pulling their hair out and say, where is all this unique DNA coming from? And so I think that will speed the implosion of the neo-Darwinian paradigm. And I think the life that it has is just the funding, you know, and the bluster and the bluffing that we see from scientists as they say, oh, this new idea is just religion. You know, and it's just the arguments are becoming so shrill and so emotional. It's really showing the panic of the Darwinian side.
Dr. Thomas Woodward is professor at Trinity College in Florida, where he teaches the history of science, communication, and systematic theology. He's author of the new book, Darwin Strikes Back, Defending the Science of Intelligent Design. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Judy was calling earlier, last segment, and Robert emailed us. I'd like both of you to contact us again at 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Send us your information. I'm going to send you a copy of Darwin Strikes Back, Defending the Science of Intelligent Design by our guest, Dr. Thomas Woodward. If you adopt the ethic, and this, for me, is not the bottom line when it comes to evolution, but it is near the bottom line. If you adopt a worldview that is essentially survival of the fittest, that those who have will survive, those who have not will not, that affects the way you view all events in human history and all events occurring today. Would a survival of the fittest see any problem with thousands, tens of thousands dying in Darfur? After all, they might not be fit enough to survive. It is only the Christian worldview, the Christ-centered, cross-focused worldview, that lends heft to that kind of concern and care that Christians express for those who may not be fit and may not be able to survive without our help. They are considered our neighbors. LCMS World Relief is bringing that Christ-centered, cross-focused care to people in Darfur, to elsewhere in the world, people affected by natural and man-made disasters. To find out more about LCMS World Relief, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or you can contact them toll-free, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, and give directly, earmark a donation for any of their many efforts around the world, LCMS World Relief. All right, we've got audio open lines ahead, starting here at about 20 minutes to the hour. We're going to run for about the next hour of the program until we're done. We've got a long way to go. Here's something we started last week on Tuesday, 1 week ago today, and then we took a little break for the holiday. Now that we're back, I want to revisit this issue of men in church. We were listening to a PBS Religion and Ethics Newsweekly feature on men in church, what some churches are doing to try and bring men back to church. So far, I'm going to pick up where we left off. I want your reactions to it, your thoughts. We had a lot of stimulating conversation with our listeners Tuesday last week. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and via email issuesetc@kfuo.org. Some of the methods that are being tried by churches trying to bring men back to the pews, because we're talking now about 60-40, women versus men on a Sunday morning. In Europe, it's 80-20. And America seems to be headed that way in terms of church attendance. Some of the things that are being tried, football church. Get men together, not to talk about football, but to use sports themes. Men huddle together like your favorite NFL team before they go out onto the line of scrimmage. Or men, the metaphors will turn from, things like sin and grace to challenging men to be all they can be. Bongo playing pastors, we heard a little bit about that. Pastors who are trying to be men's men, getting the men together for men's church. Not necessarily leaving the women out, but getting the men together and trying to help them bond together in some sort of spiritual way. Another that was proposed, another church, what they're trying? Well, they're trying to change the attitude about men toward church. They're trying to say this isn't just a women's place. This is a place where men need to step up and take their leadership role. Well, when we talked with you last week, a lot of you agreed with this idea that we really need to create a place for men to come back to church. Make men feel like they belong there. So what, if anything new, does the church need to do to bring men back to church? Here's another solution, picking up where we left off in this PBS Religion and Ethics News weekly feature, Men in Church. It has to do with a more patriotic theme.
This is Jack Elwood's congregation in the Virginia suburbs of Washington. On Veterans Day, it went a step further than most churches in honoring the military. There is a large military component here anyway, but Elwood makes a serious effort to reach out to all men. Things like this, as well as a fast-moving liturgy and short, focused sermons by Pastor Elwood, send the message that men are important here.
You can tweak a worship service to have more masculine vocabulary. For example, you can focus on challenge rather than comfort.
Come to Jesus. Come to Jesus.
But this too is part of Elwood's service. Churches like Burke Community and The Grove, both non-denominational, insist that by focusing on men, they are not trying to exclude or diminish women. They say they want to create a different type of spiritual partnership between men and women.
We're not making our services to feel like a lodge meeting for men or a locker room gathering where men only are going to feel comfortable. We want men and women to both connect with Christ in our services. The challenge is that while many women can do masculine, most men can't do feminine.
All right. Now, I'm thinking at this point, I was sitting in a church on Sunday, in fact. And they announced that they're going to start children's church, essentially children's church. It was kind of a halfway measure of children's church. not the church I go to, but a church I was at this weekend. And they said, we're going to start this program that at a certain point in the church service, the kids will be ushered out and go do their own thing, essentially right before the sermon. And I was thinking to myself, you know, here I am sitting in church. How would I characterize myself? I'm middle-aged, 42. So I'm tail-end boomer. I am, how else would I characterize myself? I'm middle-aged, middle-income, but I'm a cynic. Some people might even consider me prematurely curmudgeonly. I am. If you've listened to this program, you probably got a sense of that, even though I try to be a nice guy most of the time. Anyone who works with me will tell you, I'm not hard to work with necessarily, am I? No? No? But I'm cynic, I'm sarcastic. My tendency tends to be toward those things that really annoy people. And I kind of enjoy it. Why isn't there a church for me? Why isn't there a church for my demographic? I'm not your typical guy. I don't watch a lot of sports. So football church wouldn't appeal to me. I never served in the military, so Halls of Montezuma Church wouldn't appeal to me. Not so much. You know, maybe if a pastor were more like Dennis Miller, a guy that just rants on matters of theology for 25 minutes. I like stand-up comedy. Why can't I have a pastor that's a little bit more like my favorite stand-up comic? Why isn't... I got to thinking, if there's going to be a church for men, a church for women. Of course, they're not trying to exclude anyone. Church for kids. Why can't there be a church for me? I'm sure that there are others out there like me. You know, they say birds of a feather flock together, and if you build it, they will come. If they just had a church for guys like me, call it Cynics Church or whatever, with a service designed for things that appeal to me. I mean, if you can narrow the demographic to men or to men who have an affinity for the military or for sports, why can't you narrow the demographic for a guy like me? Really? I want to hear from you on the issue of men in church, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's audio open lines this Tuesday. We're coming to you live on November the 28th. You could have, my wife likes to watch the Home and Gardening Channel. You could have Home Improvement Church. You know, use the metaphors of home improvement. You don't have to actually teach them how to do crafts, but, or maybe you could. Remodeling church, who knows? I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there, all sorts of possibilities.
Keg party.
Keg party church. For the youth among us. Rave church. I can think of all the possibilities. I just don't understand why people aren't pursuing them. Barry calls from Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Barry, thank you for waiting.
You know, I'm still a little bit cranked up from when I heard this show last week, because there were all sorts of things I was wanted to say, but I was listening to it on the MP3s over the Internet.
MP3 church. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, let me put it this way. You know, people don't usually accuse me of being overly nice, and sometimes they suggest I'm a little bit blunt. I'd like to say that if a man has children and he isn't there on Sunday morning with his children, he's guilty of child abuse. Now, I'll say occasionally you can miss, but if a person doesn't let his children know that church is the most important thing in his week, he should be ashamed of himself, and he's helping to condemn his children to hell. And I think we need to realize that we preach the gospel every time we roll out of bed and go to church, because we're saying Jesus Christ is the most important thing in my life.
Well, Barry, I think you're right if you're talking about going to church as it has been for 20 centuries, that is the proclamation of Christ and him crucified to sinners. But what if the church is a poor man's version of Oprah Winfrey or Dr. Phil? I don't know if I'd want to encourage a man to bring his kids to a church like that.
Well, I grew up Roman Catholic, and it finally dawned on me in about seventh grade that if the Bible isn't true, there's no reason at all to get out of bed on Sunday mornings.
No, that's
and
true.
Then I took a look around at the various churches, and I tried to find one church that came closest to preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's why I'm Lutheran.
Barry, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for listening up there in Pennsylvania. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Faye calls from cell phone. Faye, welcome.
Hi. There's a church for you, Jeff. There is definitely every Sunday morning. God's there for you. And there's church for all of us. It's sad that we have to go this route, or that we think we have to go this route. You know, because men are supposed to be there, like the gentleman just before said, you know, that's his responsibility. And there's a church for all of us. And we're not supposed to be there to be entertained. We're there to worship, and God is coming to us. It's just sad that they're doing that.
Faye, thank you very much for the call. Well, I asked before, why isn't there a church for me? I'll get to that in a few minutes. There is, by the way, a church for me. Depends on what I believe my chief characteristic is. If I'm a sports fan and I want a church for me, then I'm going to look for the sports theme. If I'm a big patriot, ex-military, and that's how I define, that's my chief characteristic, then I'll go looking for a church for me where they sing the Halls of Montezuma or maybe the particular anthem from my branch of the military. I used to hunt a lot. It actually used to be an obsession. First it was golf, and then I discovered hunting, which is golf, with some satisfaction. Golf offers no satisfaction whatsoever. You chase the little ball around the open fields all day long. You hit it, and it may go where you want it to. More often, it goes where it wants to. And then I discovered hunting, which is golf with guns, where you're not chasing a little ball, but maybe a little bird. And when you do it right, you get the satisfaction of the kill. Now, come on. There were times when I, especially during certain seasons of the year, when I would eat and breathe camo. I thought the smell of gunpowder was in my nostrils constantly. What I thought of, even when I was a parish pastor, I should have been thinking of other things. What I thought of when I woke up in the morning was the next chance to get out and hunt. What about Hunter's Church? Maybe instead of the crucifix, a nice 8-point buck mounted right there over the altar. Maybe not even an altar. What would we put there? What?
Like a table that they
close. Yeah. You could put maybe a big utility sink up there. So, you know, for cleaning the kill. Maybe you could have a cross, but maybe it would be two shotguns laid across one another.
You know, if you're a premillennial dispensationalist, you can redo animal sacrifice.
That's true. That's true. You could reinstitute animal sacrifice. But I'm thinking about more of a church along the lines of the hunting lodge. Lots of mounted trophies, big roaring fire at one end, leather chairs, maybe some cigars and brandy. I mean, that could substitute for bread and wine easily. If you're catering to my particular tastes, right? If that's what I think I need when I go to church. Instead of the pastor preaching a message of sin and grace to me, he could tell me there's nothing more fascinating than hunting stories. These stories of guys getting lost or guys chasing this or chasing that. I could listen to them all day long. I could certainly take time on Sunday morning to listen to the pastor's hunting story. I'm going to toss a little Jesus in there at the end by way of a parable. Go ahead. That'd be fine. And we could do Bible lessons from like, let me see, Nimrod was a mighty hunter. I can think of that one. Or Esau, he was also out there in the field killing the game. I'm sure there were others. Who knows? I mean, even if that's all you got, it's not really about the Bible. It's after all, it's about me. It's about giving me what I need. That would bring a lot of men back to church, I'm sure. If you could call it church. Steve calls from West County. Hi, Steve.
Hey, you can have a deer stand for a pulpit.
A deer stand. The pastor could sit in a deer stand. We could strap him up there just for safety's sake.
Right. And he could wear camouflage.
He could wear camouflage. If you're liturgical, if you're one of those old-fashioned liturgical types, he could wear camo robes.
Right.
Yeah. And blaze orange. That would be the perpetual color of the church here. Blaze orange. Brilliant. Brilliant. Anything else, Steve?
Well, how about on a little bit more serious note? I think part of why do people do this is, why do men not want to go to these churches? For one thing, everybody is patronized. They patronize women. Oh, we need this type of field. Oh, we need a children's service. Every group is patronized. And now they're going to realize, oh, we need to patronize men as well. I don't know about you. I don't take patronizing very well. And I think a lot of guys don't. I think what these churches are missing is something that they can't create, and that's authenticity. And when you're patronizing people and you're excluding the Christ and the gospel, there's nothing authentic about it.
Thank you very much, Steve. That's a good insight. I like his phrase there. You can't invent authenticity. It has to come in from the outside. Authenticity is something that you are lent, not something that you invent. What they're trying to do is say, let's create an authentic environment. Can't do it. Authenticity, because the root of that word, authenticity, is similar to a root of authority. It has to come from outside of you. It can't come from within. Robert in Vermont writes this via email, how to get men to church? De-Oprify the church service. Well, that's a good beginning. That's a good diagnosis on what to take out. The question is, what do you do when you're left with no Oprah? All right, here's another email. No, let's talk with Tim, who calls from his car. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. I was just wondering, do you think Jesus went to the same temple all the time? And if he went to the one where they were the ones that killed him, did he have a problem with their teachings? Or did he go to different temples, and would he have a problem with their teachings, you know, from the time that, you know, so how did he attend church, you know, regularly?
Well, I don't know if Jesus is a great example of going to church, because he actually is the object of the church's worship. But how did Jesus worship? As far as we can tell, he worshiped like an Old Testament person of God. I mean, we hear of him going to the festivals and celebrating the festivals, although it's odd that when Jesus goes to the religious festivals of the Old Testament faith, which is in fact a faith that points toward him, he inevitably does something with it to draw the focus away from what the people had thought it was about back to himself. Primary example being Passover, when he essentially announces, this has always been all about me and my death and resurrection for sinners. Kia in Birmingham, Alabama. Is she not getting my sense of humor? Is this one of those things we talk about that, you know, that's why I wouldn't make a good pastor in one of these churches if I had to cater to women. I just wouldn't. Kia writes, with one of those little, what are those little icons called? It's a little smiley face that isn't smiling at me. Looks rather annoyed. Are you serious?
Those are called emoticons.
Emoticons. That's a word I can live without. Thank you. Are you serious, writes Kia. That music would make me not want to go to church. I think she's talking about the Dance with Jesus music. Come on, for goodness sake, she writes. I am a proponent of high church with Christ-centered sermons, and you know it works for my church. There's not one family there that does not have their husband. That's interesting. I'd like to see that church. As a matter of fact, tonight the guys are getting together for some adult beverages and chatting of the chits? I'm sorry, I don't understand what that means. What?
Must be a southern thing.
It's a southern thing. Maybe chitlins? Are they talking about?
I think it's a takeoff on chit-chat.
Oh, chatting of the chits. I'll tell you what, if we didn't have Charlie, we couldn't do the show. Well, we really couldn't do the show if we didn't have Charlie, that's for sure. I wish churches would stop trying to redo and remake the church. That is what is driving people away. The church is to be Christ-centered, not let's increase our masculine population-centered. Contrary to popular belief, we are not marketing niches. Thank you very much, Kia, and thanks for listening in Alabama. Yeah, I wrote an article on this. Oh, golly. Oh, it's for Modern Reformation magazine, and I can't remember the title of it. But it's about the unchurch, churches that decide that they are going to allow the market and the culture to dictate what they're going to be, and what they end up being is anything but church. Well, when we come back from this break, we've got more audio open lines in the third hour of the program. Your phone calls, your email, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
In the wilderness of American evangelicalism, you're listening to Issues, Etc.